It's good for us. I've also found it vital to my spiritual and mental well-being. Without being able to laugh, I don't know that I can maintain my optimism or hopefulness, or much capacity for tolerance. Laughter sustains our spirits as we bear the slings and arrows of everyday living. I can't count how many times I've said or heard others say, I can laugh or I can cry, and I'd rather laugh. Often we have some power to choose our outlook. Often we can laugh or we can cry, and laughing is a way more fun way of coping. It also carries less risk of dehydration. In his Psychology Today article, Dr. Alex Lickerman explains why laughter helps us build resilience. Neuroscientist B.S. Ramachandran theorizes that laughter evolved as a signal, both to ourselves and others, that what may appear dangerous or threatening actually isn't. As he writes, perhaps the rhythmic staccato sound of laughter evolved to inform our kin who share our genes, don't waste your precious resources on this situation. It's a false alarm. If true, this provides a plausible explanation for nervous laughter. We're signaling ourselves that whatever horrible thing we've just encountered isn't really as horrible as it appears. Something we often desperately want to believe. One of my most memorable fits of laughter for me has involved getting lost on the way to visit an aunt in Long Island. I was traveling with my mom and I carefully planned my route. Yet somehow in a moment of confusion, I missed a vital turn. By the time I realized this, I was in the middle of Manhattan. During rush hour, on the day before Thanksgiving, I do not drive in big cities. And yet, here I was, stuck in traffic in front of the Empire State Building. This was seriously not funny. And yet, I spontaneously started laughing. I'd become familiar with some theory shortly before this about how laughing helps people discharge fear and discomfort and helps us arrive at clearer thinking as a result. So I decided I'd just go with this. And it worked. I felt better, and I was better able to accept the situation and work with it. Unfortunately, my mother did not find this funny at all. She was not amused. I think the stress of being lost in New York was for her, unfortunately, exacerbated by having her daughter behind the wheel laughing maniacally for no apparent reason. I can see in retrospect that laughing helped fill that gap between the image I have of myself, that I don't or can't drive in big cities, and the stark reality that there I was, in fact, doing that. This was mixed with the relief that I was, in fact, surviving the experience, too. Laughter soothed my panic, and for that I was grateful. Laughter helps us be resilient in matters large and small. I have noticed often that when I'm telling of my father's death, I would still do it in the form of a humorous anecdote. Occasionally gotten some strange looks about this. And it's been about 13 years now. Now I have more options for coping with difficult emotions these days, but I still can't imagine making it through that situation without the release of laughter. I know I'm not alone in using laughter to get me through hard times, but I was surprised to find a quote by Mahatma Gandhi saying, if I had no sense of humor, I would long ago have committed suicide. A good laugh from time to time is necessary to save our lives, or at least our sense of well-being in a difficult situation. Laughter, however, isn't just an individual coping strategy. Laughter is a social phenomenon, and studies have shown people are 30 times more likely to laugh in social settings than when they were alone. Researchers theorized that laughter developed in humans as a way to signal the danger has passed and to strengthen human connections. Laughter causes relaxation and inhibits our fight or flight response. It is contagious, unless you're my mom, and builds group cohesion and closeness. It allows everyone to relax and be more fully present with each other. I witnessed this sort of process of bonding a few months ago when I sat in the initial OWL session. Here were kids beginning a sexuality education curriculum, and I was amazed at how quickly they seemed to form a cohesive and close group while they giggled together in the face of this sometimes uncomfortable topic. I've also experienced laughter as a way to ease tension and restore bonds in times of profound disagreement. I once had a deeply difficult conversation with an old friend where I found out just how far our theological views had diverged. Unlike the townspeople in our children's story, most people have come to their beliefs in a more complex and personal way and have a greater stake in their beliefs than simply being right about a hat color. Our beliefs are often intertwined with our sense of identity and well-being, particularly for people who've wrestled long and hard with what we believe. Now, back in college, this friend and I had both been on the more liberal, open-minded end of Catholicism, though her actually more so than me at the time. Since then, I've shifted the directions I have, and she's become a more religiously conservative, strictly biblical type of Christian. After a particularly tense conversation one evening, we awkwardly agreed to disagree. We were not going to see eye to eye on many things, but we still managed to focus on what we do still have in common. We shared a laugh over our still commonly held belief that the New York Yankees suck. Well, this was no laughing matter. Our laughter did matter. Somehow, sharing a laugh over this shifted things. I was able to know that I still have my friendship, if only in the form of shared memories and mutual goodwill from a distance. I think each of us was able to conclude that the other's beliefs are no threat to our own. Our shared laughter was able to underscore our shared humanity that transcends our differences. One famous Unitarian Universalist saying is that we need not think alike to love alike. Laughing together, despite extreme disagreement, may be the most convincing way I've ever experienced that is true. I believe humor is also important to our fourth principle. In our free and responsible search for truth and meaning, a good sense of humor does go a long way. Some of you may be familiar with the study showing that viewers of some late-night comedy shows are better informed about current events than the average. Now, this thrills me because I sometimes go through phases when The Daily Show with Jon Stewart has been my main source of news. This is an intelligent and well-put-together show that demonstrates that humor and seriousness are far from mutually exclusive. While I can't prove it, I've always thought that part of why viewers are better informed is exactly because of the humor. Let's face it, watching the news can sometimes feel like an assault of negativity and reasons to worry. I think being able to laugh allows us to relax and take it in without the threat of being overwhelmed or depressed. This can be true even in more personal contexts. Even when the truth is hard, humor can communicate things in a way that isn't threatening. As writer Mary Hirsch puts it, humor is a rubber sword. It allows you to make a point without drawing blood. And the relaxation that comes with humor can allow us to take in different ideas without feeling so defensive. I was able to gain a bit of insight about myself years later in recalling a coworker once gently making fun of me. We worked third shift at the time, running some very frustrating machinery that produced junk mail that was likely just going to go get thrown away by the recipients anyway. It was the most demoralizing job I've ever had. I was pleasantly surprised that particular evening to work with someone I could have a really good, intelligent conversation with. At one point, though, this coworker suddenly gave me a peculiar look and said to me, "You use too many big words. Don't you notice people looking at you funny?" Now, I was really concerned about this and thought for a moment before asking, "Oh, do I come across as pretentious?" and with exasperation, he replied, "Well, there you go again." I was totally taken aback, startled, and I tried to explain, but I couldn't think of a less pretentious way of saying pretentious. Before I realized, he was just enjoying giving me some grief. Now, I like to think I enjoy a good vocabulary. In fact, I think the funniest bumper sticker ever are the ones that say, "Eschew obfuscation." I love the irony of dense and inaccessible English, which translates into plain English as a warning to avoid being unclear. Now, there's nothing wrong with taking joy in this. It's a good thing. I've occasionally been able to notice, though, that communicating our ideas is often done more effectively when we speak a little more plainly. The non-threatening mirror of truth that humor provides also helped me realize something about myself, that while I grew up thinking of myself as one of the smart kids, I clung to that identity to protect me from feeling bad about myself, especially since I didn't see myself as one of the kids who was cool, or athletic, or creative, or fit in. When I was able to let go of that a bit, I think I was able to question that old belief that I needed to hold on to this identity as being smart to feel good about myself. And isn't that what we UUs do? We question our own beliefs. Dogmas are often easier to change than the more subtle beliefs that we hold about ourselves without realizing it. As UUs, I see it as a sign of well-being that we can laugh at ourselves. And Unitarian Universalists are known for our ability to do this. As a religious movement, we certainly have our share of quirks and incongruities that provide ample room for good humor. We are, after all, the religion for people who don't quite trust organized religion. Personally, I believe that being disorganized is not the answer to this, though I expect some of you will disagree. In preparing for today, I had the opportunity, and the excuse, to read quite a few UU jokes, and I'd like to share some of these with you. During discussion time, I'd be interested to hear what truth you hear, or what you think misses the mark, or what good UU jokes you've heard. Now, I was not at all surprised in my research to find there is a wide variety of opinion about the classic question of how many UUs it takes to change a light bulb. Some defer to the older Unitarian theology and say, one. Only one, definitely not three. However, most suggest that far more of us are needed for a proper quorum. My favorite answer is this. How many UUs does it take to change a light bulb? No one knows, but it's been referred to the Buildings and Grounds Committee, who are supposed to make a report at the next board meeting. Although the acting head of Buildings and Grounds, and no one admits to being head of this committee, says it's really long-range planning's job to determine whether the bulb should be changed. Because they've heard that the Social Concerns Committee thought we were wasting too much power. Although they also heard that the RA committee was upset because they thought it was unsafe for the kids to be in the dark. The Sunday Service Committee wants the light moved 3 feet to the right so that it doesn't put the speaker in shadows. The Music Committee wants a higher wattage of light so that singers can see their copies of Rise Up singing. And the Membership Committee wants a whole new bank of lights because they heard about a study that says guests prefer brighter spaces. The Pagan Group wants all electric lights removed entirely. Eventually, a renter will probably change it. We do seem to be lacking in motivated renters here ourselves. We're working on that. Now, using the democratic process is a cherished principle for us, and it's good that we can laugh at how unwieldy that can sometimes be as we honor everyone's input. It does sure beat just crying about it in the dark. And we also certainly believe in the power of democracy. I encountered the story of a group of UU Church school children who were trying to determine the sex of a rabbit. "Well, there's only one way to decide," said one child. "Let's take a vote on it." Of course, settling our matters isn't always that easy. Once a Catholic was explaining to a Unitarian Universalist friend how dogma was formulated in the Catholic Church. First it is debated by the church authorities, then when debate is ended, whatever was decided upon is declared dogma by the Pope, she explained. That's pretty much the same with us at the Unitarian Universalist. "I thought you didn't have dogma," she asked. "That's because no debate among Unitarian Universalists ever ends." We are reputed to have a huge diversity of opinions. It's been said that we all know that Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses go to people's door in pairs. When two Unitarian Universalists go to someone's door, they start a theological debate with each other. Also, supposedly, whenever you find two Jews, you find three religious opinions. UUs are amazed at such unanimity. On the other hand, we sometimes laugh at ourselves for not being quite so varied as we think. It's been observed that Unitarian Universalists agree to disagree, and then we never do. We've also had our diversity summed up as four colors of Priuses in the church parking lot. Is there some incongruity here between how diverse we think we are and the reality? I don't know. I would have to refer to the classic UU bumper sticker, "Honk if you're not sure." Even if we don't have answers, or can't figure out how to change a light bulb, much less the whole world, let us light a candle rather than curse the darkness, and may we go forth to spread love and laughter. So be it.